Welcome to the Three Creeks Church Podcast. We're a church in Gahanna, Ohio that exists to help people find and follow God. We hope this message encourages you, challenges you, and helps you discover how much God really loves you.
Well, I have the tremendous privilege of introducing our guest teacher this morning. I was thinking about it this week and how I have known and been friends with Hannah longer than Joel.
So long time.
We were friends freshman year of college, and her family moved to Columbus, how many years ago now?
Three years.
And this is somebody who is wise beyond her years. She's a really deep thinker. She has one of the highest capacities just in all things of anyone I've ever met. And she's a really, really good friend, especially to the Trainer family. And so would you guys, and I guess I should share like who you are. Hannah works for Contrast Church, one of the churches that we helped plant as the development
director.
And she actually now works part-time for My Village Ministries as well. So I have the double privilege of having her as a friend and as a coworker. So would you guys join me in welcoming Hannah to teach us this morning?
Thanks. Hi, friends. Yeah, as Morgan said, I'm Hannah, and I get to work at Contrast Church, which I just want to start this morning by saying thank you because of Three Creeks' desire to see the gospel proclaimed and to plant new churches, I get to attend my favorite church in the world. So you guys' generosity and passion for that is far-reaching and is spreading not only to other parts of Columbus, but lots of different places in the whole world. And full disclosure, Joel was once my boss. Morgan and I worked at a summer camp with him called Beulah Beach. I don't know if you've heard of it. Approximately, 100 years ago, we all worked together. And working for 24-year-old Joel is exactly what you think it would be. Incredibly fun and life-giving, but also I don't think I've ever been more tired in my whole life. I rallied, though, luckily because I was 20 years old, right? And I was living on a steady diet of assorted fun-sized snacks and peanut butter M&Ms, which got me thinking about how I've kind of always been a snack girl. My sister Allison and I recently started doing some research, very important research. Our parents were really great and always had our house stocked, for better or for worse, with all of the best snacks. Our friends knew, you come over to the Gilmore house, the pantry is going to be full. But we recently learned that not everyone grew up in a snack family like us. And this was brand new information to us. We were only confronted with this information when we were at a friend's house watching TV, and we said, hey, what snacks do you have? And he looked at us with kind of like a blank stare and was like, I don't know, I might have some ice cream in my freezer. Are you kidding me? First of all, ice cream is not a snack, it's a dessert. Second of all, how can you have no snacks? No chips, no Cheez-Its, no goldfish, no taquitos, no pizza rolls, no bottom of the freezer deliciousness. This was a shocking experience for my sister and I, and it has led to us slowly kind of just surveying our friends to who grew up in a snack family and who didn't, and subsequently thinks that bottom of the freezer ice cream counts as snacks. And the data has revealed some crazy information. One friend that we talked to actually told us that their go-to after-school snack in high school was toast with peanut butter. So just like maybe take a moment of silence for them and their childhood. My poor husband, Adam, he grew up in an almond family, if you know, you know. And over the course of our 15 years together, I have convinced him that one piece of extra dark chocolate after dinner does not actually also count as a snack. All this to say, I digress. How you dealt with your hunger post some sort of high school sports practice or theater practice seems to be a pretty cultural experience, right? And it was kind of dictated by your family of origin. And growing up in a poor community 2,000 years ago in Israel, I cannot imagine that Jesus grew up in a snack family, but the metaphor surely wasn't lost on him, because I assume that kids have been asking for snacks approximately 3 seconds after their parents have attempted to feed them an actual meal that they probably worked really hard on. And since that scenario has existed since probably the fall of humanity, I know there had to have been at least one instance of Jesus asking his mom for a snack because he was hungry. Which brings us to our text for this morning. We are going to continue on in the Beatitudes. We are going to be in Matthew 5:6. I'm going to read this for us this morning. It's going to be on the screens behind me. And it says, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they will be satisfied." So as we jump into this beatitude, we are going to talk this morning about what it looks like to hunger and thirst, not for the purple Doritos, which are the superior Dorito flavor, but for righteousness. So I'm going to pray really quick, and then we're going to hop in. Jesus, thank you so much for your goodness to us expressed in every page of the Bible, expressed in the Sermon on the Mount and the Beatitudes. We pray that you would give us fresh eyes to see this text this morning and an open heart to receive what you have for us. I pray that as we explore this in community this morning, that your faithfulness would abound in ways that we have never experienced before, and that we would continue to be hungry and thirsty for righteousness in ways that honor you. Amen. So let's back up for a second and take a look at what we mean by the word blessed. In case you haven't been paying close attention, these past 3 weeks, you all have been in a sermon series called The Blessed Life. And the blessed life, translated, we talk about blessed, blessed, it's the Greek word makarios. And Joel has talked a little bit about this, but makarios is actually a pretty difficult word, phrase to know how to translate, and we know that it actually isn't even really the word for blessing, and I think there we do kind of the heart of Jesus' meaning sometimes a disservice by transposing our own definition of our English definition of words onto the words that he was using. So a fun fact about Jesus is that he was actually trilingual. The written and official language of this time period would have been Greek, which is why we have the New Testament translated from Greek. But the common language of his people, the Jewish people, would have been Aramaic, which is a cousin language to Hebrew, which is what we have the Old Testament translated from. And Jesus would have been fluent in that because he was a good Jewish boy who went to Torah school. So when we read the New Testament today, in 2025, what we're actually reading is an English translation of a Greek translation of the words that Jesus was speaking in Aramaic. So you can see how we got here when we dig a little bit deeper into biblical words and we realize, like, oh, the word that we're using isn't actually doing a very good job of portraying what Jesus was actually trying to communicate. Sometimes I feel like digging deeper into biblical words feels like playing a centuries-long game of telephone, you know, the game where you, like, whisper into the person's ear and then the next person whispers, and 2,000 years later, here we are with the NIV. So the Hebrew word that we use for makarios is asherai. So what I think we have to remember, too, is the people that Jesus was speaking to when he was preaching the Sermon on the Mount were just the average Jewish listener, right? They also, if they were a male, they had gone to Torah school. Probably they knew the Hebrew, Old Testament, the Torah. And so when Jesus was saying these words in Aramaic, it was hyperlinking things that they already knew that we take for granted and that we don't realize because we did not grow up in a Jewish family 2,000 years ago. And so sometimes it's really helpful for us to take the word in Greek and look at what is the sister word in Hebrew. And so the sister word of makarios in Hebrew would have been asherai. And what asherai refers to is one person is looking at the circumstance of another person and declaring that they are experiencing the blessed life based on whatever is currently happening in their life. So the phrase would be, oh, how asherai is that person. Blessing isn't a thing that you obtain, right? It's an opinion about who is in this blessed state of life. So who is asherai? We see a lot of examples of this in the Old Testament, specifically in Psalms. And so we are going to look at Psalm 1 this morning, where the average listener of the Sermon on the Mount would have easily triggered in their brain, like, oh, okay, he's saying this thing, and this is what this makes me think of. So the author of Psalm 1 says, "How blessed is the one who does not follow the advice of the wicked, or stand in the pathway of sinners, or sit in the assembly of scoffers. Instead, he finds pleasure in obeying the Lord's commands. He meditates on his commands day and night. He is like a tree planted by flowing streams. It yields its fruit at the proper time, and its leaves never fall off. He succeeds in everything he attempts. Sounds pretty Asherah to me. The psalmist is saying, man, look at this guy. He is living the blessed life. So we can contextualize this a little bit into our life here in Columbus. Maybe we would say, Asherah is the one who gets free tickets to the OSU Michigan game, and the weather is 65 degrees and sunny, and they win by 50 points, and they find free parking right by the stadium. That person is living the blessed life. Or this one is my favorite. Asherah is the person whose parents come into town to visit, and they take them to lunch at North Star and then ice cream at Jenny's. That's one of my favorites. And this is why the Beatitudes are so cool, right? Jesus isn't praying for the community to have these things, right? He isn't saying, I hope you're hungry and thirsty. I hope that you grieve. I hope that you're proud. What he is saying is that from his vantage point, these are the people who are living the blessed life. And their reward for that state of life is the blessing that you're experiencing, right? And so when you mourn, when you have humility, when you hunger and thirst, that's when you're living this blessed life. And in every sense of the Beatitudes, I don't know if you guys have noticed this, but the perspective is in the first part of the line, and then the blessing comes in the second. So Jesus is revealing these reversals that are going to exist in his upside-down kingdom, and then he's going to elaborate on those further in the rest of the Sermon on the Mount. So let's find out why Jesus is telling people that are hungry and thirsty that they're going to live the blessed life, because I do not feel like I am living the blessed life when I am hungry. When I first found out that I was teaching on this particular beatitude, I was pumped, because no one loves being righteous like an oldest child, specifically an oldest daughter. Probably, yeah. If you're an oldest daughter, you get it. My friend sent me a meme the other day that said the strongest man you'll ever meet is a firstborn daughter, so I think you get it. The Greek word that we find here for righteousness is dikaiosyne, which can be translated as righteousness, and a lot of times we do translate it like that, but it's actually overwhelmingly concerned with right conduct and living the way that God requires. And so I hope that we can walk away from this morning better understanding that hungering and thirsting for righteousness is actually a lot less about doing the right things than it is being in right relationship with other people and having right conduct towards these people in our lives. And I know that you guys did not sign up for the level of word study that we've been doing during this teaching, and I'm so sorry, but I love this stuff, so this is what you're getting this morning. But when your whole passage is 8 words, you got to dig a little bit deeper into some of this and assume that the words that Jesus was using and what he was trying to communicate was very, very intentional. So what's happening with this Greek word, dikaiosyne, is the same thing that's happening with makarios, right? We got to look at the Aramaic word to see what Jesus was really trying to communicate here. And so the Aramaic word is tzedakah. Tzedakah refers to the character of someone who's in right relationship with the people around them. It can also refer to God putting right what is wrong in the world or wrong in a situation. And when we use the word tzedakah, we are talking about all relationships being equitable and in right standing with one another. We're treating each other rightly. Tzedakah is actually most often used in the Old Testament when people who are responsible for creating or ensuring tzedakah are doing a really terrible job of it. So we are going to pop over to Jeremiah 22:3. We see these warnings from the prophets about doing tzedakah, doing justice, really frequently, but I feel like this specific example in Jeremiah really helps us understand the context of this. So we're going to read Jeremiah 22:3, which says, "The Lord says, do what is just and right. Deliver those who have been robbed from those who oppress them. Do not exploit or mistreat resident foreigners who live in your land, children who have no fathers or widows, and do not kill innocent people in this land." So what's happening here is we have the prophet Jeremiah, and he's talking to the wicked king of Judah. Judah had a lot of different kings. Some are good, some are bad. This one happened to be a bad one. And what he's saying is, hey, you need to do justice and tzedakah instead of what's actually happening in your kingdom, which is violence and oppression and the hoarding of wealth. because violence and oppression are the exact opposite of tzedakah, and these are often enacted upon the least of these, right, in our communities. The poor, the immigrant, the orphan, the widows, basically everyone who was closest to the heart of Jesus. And do you know why God was so explicit about this in the Old Testament and why the prophets talked about this so much? Because the Israelites were all of these things like 7 seconds before they started oppressing other people. They were poor immigrants in a strange land, and God wrote these things into their laws and had the prophets talk about them all the time because he knew that the minute the Israelites got just a little bit of power and wealth, they would immediately forget where they came from and what God had brought them up out of. Tzedakah is here when nobody is being oppressed and nobody is going without what they need for life and flourishing. There's no situation where someone has abundance and someone else is starving. No one has all the power while someone else has none. It's total equity in relationship. That's tzedakah. My husband Adam and I have 2 boys, ages 6 and 8, and they are so great. But do you know what we spend the most time doing as parents? Teaching our kids how to live in right relationship with other humans, most often each other. Because we have moved far past the physical stage of parenting, and we are well into the mental warfare stage. Unless you get it confused, it's our children who are waging the mental warfare on us. Because if it was up to either of our boys, right, and their sin nature, there would be nothing but oppression and inequality in their relationships with other people, and especially each other. I don't think you truly know the depths of the sin nature until you have found a bunch of your son's Legos in the couch, and upon asking him, hey, why are your Legos in the couch, he says, oh, I was done playing with them, but I didn't want my brother to play with them. It's not a bad plan, it's just a sinful one. So this whole concept of tzedakah, right relationship, it's all connected to our beatitude from 2 weeks ago. If you guys remember, Joel taught on grieving and mourning and how Jesus says, blessed are those who are going to mourn. Jesus is grieved over the lack of right relationship in the world, and we should be too. It's almost like we should be hungry and thirsty for them. So my mom lives with us, and it's so great, and she is such a blessing to our family, and we love it. But sometimes she comments on what you're eating. You know, she's been telling me I'm not eating enough protein, and I'm here to tell you that she is right. I've been a vegetarian since college, and if we're being honest, I think that combined with my aforementioned love of snacks is starting to catch up with me because I am tired. And maybe I'm just a regular person in their 30s with 2 kids and 2 jobs and a lot of things, tired, and then... But then some days I think I'm dying, and then I have a glass of water and a smoothie, and I think, oh, maybe there is something to this balanced diet thing. And maybe I should be more intentional about giving my body the things it needs because I am no longer a 23-year-old working at summer camp, living off of Pringles and my hopes and dreams for the future. If you are 23 and living off your hopes and dreams for the future, I encourage you just ride that out as long as you can. Godspeed to you. Because if you're hungry and you're starving your physical body, much like me, one of the first things you're going to notice is that you're weary and you're tired. And I wonder if that isn't also true for our spiritual lives. We aren't just hungry in our spiritual lives, we're actually starving. Because when I talk to my friends, both inside and outside of the church, one of the most common things I hear is I'm tired, I don't have energy, I can't stop myself from getting home and just rotting on the couch, which thank you, Gen Z, for teaching me that very graphic phrase. And I'm curious as to if this is our soul's way of telling us that it's actually starving, right? It's so hungry for these practices that Jesus tells us will bring us into abundant life, right? Things like a rich and meaningful prayer life, time spent in stillness and quiet, life-giving and honest community, rest, Sabbath, regular fasting, which seems counterintuitive, but sometimes the best way to combat spiritual hunger is with physical hunger. But instead of giving it these things that it's craving and it's asking for, we are feeding it the cheap garbage of consuming content that takes the edge off of the hunger pains but never nourishes us in any sort of meaningful way or allows us to have that sustained spiritual or emotional energy that we so desperately crave. And maybe this is a dumb analogy, and honestly, I should be eating more protein, but hunger and thirst are deep and primitive longings, right? And it's no coincidence that Jesus uses them to describe our desire for things to be right in this world. So I want you to think with me for a second of a time when you were most hungry or most thirsty. If you ask our children, they would tell you that they almost perished from thirst a few weeks ago while driving back to our house from Quarry Trails and having to wait till we got home to get water. It was touch and go for a while, but they did make it. But for most of us, I think it's really hard to legitimately remember a time when we were physically hungry, physically thirsty for a long period of time, but we face that spiritual hunger every day. And hungering and thirsting are uncomfortable, right? They're signaling to us that we need something that we aren't currently experiencing, and we're agitated and discontent because of it. And I don't know if anyone else can relate to this, but much like hunger and thirst, I actually feel relational stress, that lack of tzedakah. I feel it in my gut. If I am fighting with my husband, if I need to have a hard conversation with someone, if I have said something dumb that I know I'm going to have to apologize for it later, I feel it all in my gut. And my body lets me know that something is wrong, right? It's this constant nagging reminder that things aren't how they should be. Something else that I found kind of interesting about hunger and thirst is that these are characteristics, again, of the oppressed and the downtrodden. All the people that Jesus is speaking to during his Sermon on the Mount, his disciples, everyone sitting on that hillside, all these people know the pain of hunger and thirst, right? They are living in an oppressive empire with little to no power over their circumstances, and they know what it is like to occasionally or often go to bed with an empty stomach. So when Jesus says to them, the blessed life is for those who are hungry and thirsty for righteousness, they get it. That resonates really strongly with them. And as I mentioned earlier, every line of the Beatitudes, we have the perspective in that first part, and then we have the blessing in the second. So the perspective in this particular phrase is that something isn't right in our relationships with others, and we're hungry for that rightness. And the blessing is that we're going to be filled, but how will we be filled? Jesus is telling us that the blessed life looks like being someone who does right by God and is in right relationship with God, which means you are someone who does right by other people, right? So in the Old Testament, we see humans do tzedakah because God, Yahweh, does tzedakah first. He's modeling this for us. He loves it when people do right by each other because we are coming into fullness of life, and so are they. And that's where being satisfied comes into the equation. If you are hungry for things to be right in this world, and if you desire a time and a place where there's true justice and everybody does right by everybody else, Jesus is telling you that day is coming and you're going to be satisfied. And if you're not hungry for this, I would gently say that you may not be paying enough attention to the world that we are currently living in. Because the Beatitudes aren't just a list of things that we need to be doing or ways we need to try to live our life. Jesus isn't saying, okay, you need to do this, you need to do this, you need to do this, and then you're going to experience that blessed life, right? He's just pointing out the kind of people that are going to be in his upside-down kingdom. But there are absolutely things that you can do about your hunger and your thirst when you have the power and the influence and the resources that we have. We are not without the ability to satiate our hunger for righteousness on this side of heaven. And it should bother us when the world isn't lined up with God's sense of right and wrong. And just as I make moves to get myself food and water when I'm hungry and thirsty, I need to be intentional and active about helping to set things right in the spaces that I am in. There's no excuse for us not to do justice and tzedakah in the spaces where we have agency. And I was listening to a podcast the other day, and the speaker talked about Galatians 6:2. And I felt like, wow, this is what Jesus is talking about when he's talking about hungering and thirsting for righteousness. Galatians 6:2 says, "Carry one another's burdens, and in this way, you will fulfill the law of Christ." Carrying one another's burdens isn't just a good idea that Jesus suggests for us. It is how we fulfill the law of Christ. It's how we do right by God and we do right by other people. This is the righteousness that Jesus is talking about. And you're allowed to do something about injustice. In fact, I would say Jesus calls us to that every day. And I'm not here to tell you what that looks like for you in your own life, but I can tell you a little bit about what this looks like in my life and my husband Adam's life. So our family recently became a host family with one of our local impact partners, My Village Ministries, which Three Creeks is also a My Village Ministries church. MVM exists to connect church communities to families in crisis so that kids don't unnecessarily end up in foster care, because MVM believes that the two greatest things that the church has to offer is the gospel and our community. A few months ago, we got to have our first hosting. We hosted a 7-year-old boy and a 15-year-old girl, and they are being raised by their 20-year-old sister because their mom is dealing with substance abuse issues. And this sister, the 20-year-old sister, reached out to MVM and asked for a hosting because she's trying to put herself through college, pay all the bills, she needed to deal with some medical stuff, and she was just tired, and she needed a break, and she loved her siblings, and she was happy to be able to support them in this way, but she was also 20 and needed some support. And I'm not here this morning to talk to you about the systematic social structures that are in place that got this girl to where she is in life. What I am here to tell you is that Adam and I got the opportunity to step out and try to bring a little bit of tzedakah into our world here in Columbus. But saying yes made our own lives a lot harder. Right? We had 2 extra people living in our space. We had to figure out food for 2 kids whose main diet staple appeared to be Takis. We had to figure out extra school pickups, drop-offs. We had to deal with conflict with the kids. We had a 6, a 7, an 8-year-old boy all living in our house together. So there was just a lot happening there. And lots of different points, Adam and I looked at each other and we said, what are we doing? Why did we say yes to this? One of the most challenging parts is that our 15-year-old friend, who we hosted, she had been suspended from school when we hosted her, so she just hung out with me basically the whole week. I started introducing her to people as my intern because I took her to all my jobs, and I took her to Bible study, and I took her to lunch with my friends, and there were so many moments where I thought, oh my gosh, this girl surely cannot wait to get away from me. And she must be so tired of being drug around Columbus to all these random places with these people she's never met before. But I pushed through, and I dug into my camp counselor repertoire, and I asked her all the questions, you know, if you could only eat 5 foods for the rest of your life, what would they be? Those kind of things. And I let her control the Spotify in the car, and I got her Starbucks, and I tried to get her to look at me instead of look at her phone. And sometimes we just sat in my car in silence and we drove, and I tried to remember that even though it felt like I wasn't doing anything for this girl, that so many times Jesus had taught me that sometimes just being present is enough. And when I dropped her off at home on Friday, I gave her a hug and I said, hey, I love you, and I am so glad that I got to spend this week with you. And she said, I love you too, and just so you know, I would come back to your house another time. And I was like, okay, be cool, be cool, be cool. And in that moment, I felt that hunger and that thirst for righteousness that Jesus was talking about become a little more satisfied on this side of heaven. So I don't know what this looks like for you. Maybe it's volunteering with My Village Ministries or any of the other great local partners that Three Creeks partners with. But I wonder if it's time for us to ask the question that my husband and I often ask our boys, and that is, can you make your own life harder to make someone else's life easier, to bring tzedakah into the spaces that you exist in now, in Ohio, in 2025? Jesus' kingdom is both now and it's not yet, right? And we won't be fully satisfied from these hunger pains for right relationship with God and each other until Jesus restores all things. But Jesus has given us spaces, opportunities to actively engage in this work of restoration and bringing this to reality right now. But just a reminder, we have to feed ourselves before we feed others. If we are starving our souls, we will not be able to bring right relationships into our world unless we're actively putting ourselves in a place to be in right relationship with God first, and we're feeding our souls those things that it needs.
Thanks for listening to the Three Creeks Church podcast. To find out more about our church, to give online, or to attend a service, visit threecreekschurch.com.